take this opportunity to welcome as our speaker Bobby J from the Monterey area. Bobby J.
Bobby and I am an
addict.
I'll start off by thanking Pancho and the committee and anybody who was responsible for having me come over and share my experience, strength, and hope with them. With my brothers here in recovery in Tulare. Anytime I get asked to go and speak anywhere, it's an honor. Before I got here, I wasn't asked to come anywhere. I was asked to not come back. That's what happened with me. I'll tell you to start with my claim date is February the 28th, 1984. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I like my sponsor and my grand sponsors, we believe in this program, we love this program, and we believe in the 12 steps of recovery. I'd like to welcome all the newcomers here. I'm glad that you're here, and I hope you stick around. I also want to welcome all the old-timers, and I'm glad that you're here, and I also want to welcome the sometimers. I'm glad that you're here. Now, I came down last night with my wife, and we stopped at the motel and spent the night. And I tell you, it's not the Ritz, but I woke up this morning with a massive headache. In 77, I was in a wreck, and I messed up my back and my neck. I still got screws inside of me holding me together. And so getting old, you know, it's not for wussies. And I think some of you guys can relate to that. I see some gray around here. I'll start off by telling you that I come from a little town called Hollister, California. Born and raised there. I did a lot of my ripping and running there. I also made a few geographicals, and it didn't matter where I ended up. The outcome was always the same. I'd get loaded, get in trouble, and I had to leave. So I ended up going back to Hollister in 77 after I was in a wreck, and I couldn't take care of myself. My wife at the time had left me prior to that. And so I went back, and my mom and dad let me stay with them. And after that wreck in 1977, I thought any normal person who had been in a wreck where you were pronounced dead, covered up by a blanket, by the highway patrol, and ended up living, the doctor told me that, first thing the doctor told me when I came out of it 3 days later, he said, by all laws of nature, you should be dead. I'd done everything medically that I could do for you. And everything that I did for you should not have saved your life. I don't know why you're alive. He said, somebody upstairs likes you. And I got pissed off at him. And the reason I got pissed off was because I was living a life that was full of emotional, physical, and mental anguish. My disease took me to places that I never dreamed that any human being could ever be taken to, spiritually and emotionally. And when he told me that there's the man upstairs must like you, that scared me even more. And the reason I say that is because I was born and raised a Catholic. My mother made me say my prayers every night before I went to bed, and if I didn't, I'd get a beating. And it was not strange to me. I mean, beatings were not strange to me because I was raised by two alcoholics who liked to do that kind of stuff for some reason. Now, I'm not saying my mom and dad were bad people. My mom and dad loved me. My mom and dad were good people. They just didn't have the parenting skills. You know, back then, what they called discipline, today they call child abuse. And if I would have known I could have dialed 911 and got CPS on that, I would have been out of there a long time ago. But they did the best they could. And I love my mom and dad. God bless them. May they rest in peace, both of them. They died from this disease. When I was a kid growing up, my mother used to make me go to catechism, made me go to church every Sunday. She even wanted me to be an altar boy. But I just wasn't picked to be an altar boy. So I went to catechism. And we used to live out in the country in this area called the Simas. It was a 1 to 8th grade. It was a school. And in the 4th grade, they started coming, picking us up and taking us to catechism. I don't know if some of you may know what catechism is. It's where they teach you about God. They teach you about the Bible, the church. They teach you about Catholicism. Well, what I learned was that God was a punishing God, and that I would get hit in the head with rulers and hit on my knuckles with wooden spoons. Well, they didn't have wooden spoons back then. It was metal spoons. And I'd get erasers thrown at me, and I would be yelled at by the nuns and saying that I was a sinner and I was going to burn in hell if I didn't change my ways. And I'm 8 years old. One year I did so bad that it pissed off this God, and he scared the shit out of me. My mom was on their side, too, because she used to buy crucifixes that glow in the dark and hang them up in my bedroom. That became my kukui. That scared the hell out of me every time I woke up. Because I peed the bed a lot because of that, because I was afraid to get out of bed. So anyway, when I turned 12 and I picked up, by the time I was 15, I figured I was done. And I was afraid that this God, I always had to keep looking over my shoulder because they told me that God don't like sinners. And I was a sinner because I was using drugs. And I figured by the time I was 15 years old, I was ass out, meaning that I was condemned to a life in hell. And the reason I say that is because what I learned in catechism was that everybody was born with a certain amount of grace. And in order to get into heaven, you had to have some of this grace left to cash in. And the way you lost it was by committing sins. And what I was taught was that there's two types of sins. Mortal sins and venial sins. One was worse than the other. It's like felonies and misdemeanors. I figured by the time I was 15, I didn't have any more grace and that God was going to get me. So I started, I don't know about anybody else, but I became a real good liar. And I used to say things that, like, there's no God. God is dead. I would much rather believe that aliens planted me here on this earth as an experiment and were going to come back and pick me up one day. I'm still waiting. So when that doctor told me that, that's what pissed me off. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I was in my disease, and even today, when I get scared, I get angry. Because I believe that anger and fear run on the same vein. And one turns into the other. And back then I couldn't tell you that I was afraid, so I had to act like I was angry. And they told me I had to stay in that hospital for 3 months. I had dislocated my hip, had compound fracture on my knee, shattered my ankle in 3 places. Thank you. And they had me in a body cast. Well, they wanted to put me in a body cast, but they couldn't because of the surgery they did on my hip and my knee. And the doctor said, you're going to have to stay here for at least 3 months. I told him, you know what? You're crazy. I'm leaving here today. And that was the day that I woke up. And they sat me up, and as soon as they sat me up, I threw up. I was strung out on heroin at the time, and the doctor detoxed me with morphine, which is a good substitute. But when I got out of there, after everything that had happened to me, you would think that this was a good time to quit. Well, that didn't happen because I had friends coming into the hospital and giving me dope when I was in there. And when I left, I went back to Hollister, and I hooked up immediately with my old connections, who had started slinging some snack at the time, and I was back in. We don't have to know anybody to get loaded anywhere. I mean, you could blindfold me, put me in an airplane, and parachute me out anywhere, and within a couple hours, I'd be loaded. Because I knew how to lie, I knew how to cheat, I knew how to steal, I knew what I needed to do to survive out there. What was tough for me is when I got clean, I didn't know how to survive without using those tools. For 20 years, I used dope. And one night, I was at I was sitting at this house that me and this girl that I had been dating for a couple of years, and we were in this, let's see, who can hurt who the most relationships. And she decided she needed to leave me and go to the program because she couldn't live the way she was living anymore. And I said, all right. I said, why? She said, well, I can't hang out with people that use and get mad. And I said, are you referring to me? And she says, yeah. And that pissed me off when she told me that. And she said, but the last thing she said before she left was that if you ever want some help, give us a call. That's what she said. What I heard was, give me a call. So a couple of months went by, and I saw her and her friend, and they looked better, and they got jobs, and they got let back into their houses. Her mother threw her out of the house, and her brother threw her out of the house because she was hanging out with me. They nicknamed me the resident Techno Hollister at the time. And I swore that if I ever got my hands on her older brother, I was going to break him in half because he called the cops on me several times. I had her kids taken away from her because she was hanging out with me. So about 2 months after she left, I decided, well, maybe I should try it. Maybe we can get back together. That's what the disease up here was telling me. And before I made that call, I was with my compadre, who, by the way, had not let me in his house for a long time. I had a lot of friends who would turn off the light when they saw me coming and lock the doors. And if they did let me in the house, they would keep the kids in the living room with me when they went to the bathroom just to keep an eye on me so I didn't rip them off. Because I was a thief. I was sitting with him one night. We were drinking. And, of course, I was fixed and he wasn't. And we were about 5 o'clock in the morning. I started telling him about these meetings. Because I had been going to these meetings with her. And I told her about these meetings. And I said, they're not working. And he tells me, Bobby, you got to keep going. I said, why? I said, you know, because when I told him was something that I'd never told anybody else. And you know, when you're high and your defenses are down and you get emotional and you're with your homeboy, and I started crying. And what I told him was that I wanted to die. Now, I had tried a couple of times, but I didn't have the guts to pull the trigger. And I told him, I said, I don't want to live like this anymore. And I don't know how to stop. I can't stop. And you know, and him and all my other friends that I shot dope with were telling me, you got a problem, Bobby, you need to go get help. You know, and it's pretty bad when you're in the gutter and your homeboys that are around the campfire with you in the gutter telling you, get out. I mean, where are you going to go? And he tells me, because me and him, we grew up together. And his mom was an alcoholic and my mom was an alcoholic. He didn't like coming to my house because my mom would yell at him. I didn't like going to his house because his mom would yell at me. So we used to whistle at each other out the window. I mean, outside. And we'd sneak out the window to go hang out. And he says, yo, Bobby, you need to keep going to those meetings because they helped my mom. His mom died with over 30-something years of sobriety. She helped start the Spanish AA in Hollister. And he says, if they could work for my mom, it could work for you. So I want you to keep going, he said. And so that night, I mean, I didn't sleep that much that day. And that night, it was getting kind of late. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was suffering from the didn't wants and didn't know what I wanted. And something in my head said, go to a meeting. Now, I had been, like I said, I had been going to these meetings in the hopes of getting her back. But I'd go to the meetings late and I sat way in the back. I didn't talk to anybody. Definitely wasn't going to hold your hand and pray with you. Nobody talked to me. Nobody invited me to coffee afterwards. And then one night that I decided to go to that meeting, I went to this meeting. And it was at the American Legion. It was in the alley. And when I made that call to her, I called her and I told her, do you think you can take me a meeting? First time I went, she said, sure. We'll pick you up around 7:30. Can you stay clean until then? And I said, yeah, no problem. So I hung up and I got my old cottons out and I beat them and emptied out all the booze bottles that I had because I was pretty sick and I needed something. And by the time she picked me up, she didn't pick me up. What I heard was, I will pick you up, but they came to pick me up. And they put me in the back seat of the car. And all day long I was thinking that, see, I had ripped off a bunch of dealers in town and a lot of people were after me. And I figured, she's still pissed off at me. She's going to get all these people I owe money to at that meeting and they're going to take care of me. They're going to jump me. And so I'm sitting in the back seat going to this meeting, and they got the radio on real loud, and they're talking, and I couldn't hear what they were saying because they had the radio on loud in the back, and I knew they were talking about me, how they were going to set me up. And so when I got to the meeting, I walked into this meeting, and everybody in that room was staring at me when I walked through the door, like they were waiting for me. All six or seven of them were waiting for me. And they invited me to come and sit at a table with them. I said, I'm a dope fiend from the street. Did a lot of barroom drinking and fighting. You know, when I'm in an unfamiliar place, I need to watch my back. And I was there alone. So I sat against the wall while they sat way over there on their table. And they invited me several times to come and sit with them at the table. I said, no, I'm fine right here. Well, I don't remember anything about that meeting except for two things. One woman was complaining about her car breaking down, and this other guy was complaining about his dog shitting in his shoe. And I didn't know what that had to do with me not putting needles in my arms anymore, because that's all I really wanted to do. I didn't want to stop smoking that non-habit for me. Ha-ha. I'd smoked that every day for 20 years and never became addicted to it. I didn't want to stop drinking that liquid drug. I loved that stuff. Drank it every day. All I really wanted to do was quit putting needles in my arms, because that's what my mind told me was the problem. So they took me home and they said, okay, we'll pick you up tomorrow at the same time. And I said, why? They said, well, we're going to go to another meeting. I said, yeah, but why? I'm going to use now. I mean, this meeting didn't help me, so why should I keep going to these damn meetings? They said, that's the way we do it. So they took me to a meeting every day that week. I went to seven meetings. The same people, the same three people picked me up in the same car and took me to a different meeting every night. In three different towns, Salinas, Gilroy, and Hollister. And the night they left me off, they said, tomorrow is going to be that same meeting we took you to last week. Now you know where they all are. Now you're on your own, motherfucker. She rolled the window up and they left. I said, I know what she's doing. She don't want me to go to these meetings. I'll show her. I'll go. So, like I said, I had been going for a while, and I was still using every day, still drinking every day. And that night, my friend told me, you got to keep going to those meetings. That night, I went to a meeting, and I went late, and I waited in my favorite spot by the coffee urn in the back. And the guy who was speaking, he said, as soon as I sat down, he ended his pitch. And he says, I think I want to hear from Bobby tonight. And I said, shit, I didn't even know they knew my name. And everybody turned around to stare at me, just like you guys are right. And I looked around the room and I said, you know what? I don't like you people. I don't want to be here. I think you're all a bunch of assholes and I want you to all leave me alone. And somebody yells out, keep coming back, Bobby. That pissed me off. So this guy, his name was Richard, who was the brother of this girl that I was with, he came up to me. Now, this is the guy I swore that I was going to break in half if I ever got my hands on him. He walked up to me and he says, Bobby, it's time you and I had a talk. You want to talk? And I put on the ugliest, dirtiest barroom brawl look on my face that I could muster up, and I looked him right in the eye, and I heard somebody say yes, and I turned around, and the wall was right there, so it had to be me that said that. Because I believe that there's a saying that when you are backed up against the wall, and the fear overcomes you, then you're going to have to do something. And I said yes, and I followed through with it. And we went and we sat and at this old building on 4th Street in Hollister, and we went into the kitchen. And he put out a pot of coffee and tells me to sit down. And he starts asking me questions. Not so much about what I did, because he knew what I did. But he started asking me questions about these feelings that I was having. He was telling me about the fears, about the anxiety, about the loneliness. And I asked him, has your sister been talking to you about me? Because everything that he was saying was hitting home. And at that moment when he was asking me those questions, I broke down and started crying. And he says, let's pray. Now, one of the things, and he actually sat down and held my hands. And one of the things I didn't like about Richard, Richard was homosexual. And I didn't want, you know, at the time, I didn't know what the term meant, but I was homophobic. It's no longer that way now. But then, when he grabbed my hand, I didn't want to hold his hand. And he says, let's pray. But I didn't let go, and I felt so ashamed because I couldn't remember the words to the prayers. And he says, just do the best you can. I'll say them. And he started praying. And at that moment, he started praying. Something happened to me. I started getting this sensation at the top of my neck. And by the time it worked its way down, I had taken a lot. I was one of them garbage can junkies. You give me something, and I'll take it. And then after I swallowed it, I'd ask you, what's it going to do to me? That's the type of dopamine I was. And I had never felt this feeling before. And by the time it worked its way to my shoulders, it scared the shit out of me. And now as soon as I was getting ready to take off, he squeezed my hands, and I looked at him, and he said, don't run, that's the Holy Spirit. And I didn't tell him what was going on. He said, let's get on our knees and pray. So we got down on our knees and prayed. He prayed, I cried. Snots and the whole thing were coming down. But something happened to me that night, and I haven't had to put a needle in my arm since that night. And Richard became my mentor. Richard and I became real good friends, and I hung out with him, and he taught me a lot about recovery. And I started going to meetings, and I had a whole different attitude when I went to the meetings. I would go early. I would help set up. I'd put ashtrays out. I'd help make coffee. I'd help clean up afterwards. It got to the point where people were asking me, are you loaded? Because I wasn't acting like that before, you know? And I'd go to these meetings, and I didn't want to go home because I was told that an addict alone is an addict in bad company. And I was alone a lot. So I hung out with people I didn't even like. After the meeting, they'd get invited to coffee. I didn't have any money, and they'd buy me coffee. Sometimes they'd even buy me a piece of pie. And I hung out with these people. And after about 30 days, I decided I couldn't stay in town because it was like gun smoke, Dodge City, all these gunslingers around, they were slinging dope, and I knew everybody in town. I knew half the town, the other half of them knew me. Now, I was a legend in my own mind is what I was. So I moved to Salinas, my older brother let me stay with him, and I started going to meetings there. My first meeting in Salinas, I was elected to GSR. They waived the clean time, all seven of them. And then the next night they took me to another meeting and I was elected secretary. They waived the clean time. All seven of them. Now there was only like three meetings back in 1984, NA meetings in Salinas. So as quiet as it's kept, I went to meetings every day and I had to go to the other fellowship because I needed something. It's not like that now. We have maybe 50 meetings a week in Salinas and in Monterey. There's even more. The fellowship has grown tremendously. I'm not taking any credit for it. I just got up, suited up, and showed up. That's what I was supposed to do. But through the years, I got involved in service. And I used to be a service junkie, and I OD'd on service. And I used to go to my sponsor and tell him that these idiots in area service, they don't know what the hell they're doing. I'm going to punch this dude out, and I'm going to kick her ass. What he told me was, man does not live by area service alone. You know, it's okay not to be in service. You're going to meetings and working with newcomers, that's being a service. So, but I was at the area service level. I went to the region. I was on the convention committee. I was 1986, I was the vice chair of the convention in Monterey. I mean, what had happened to me was that I got afflicted by the secondary illness of this disease called big shotitis. And I thought I was important. You know, and it doesn't matter what level of service you're doing, you're just a trusted servant. That's it. And I forgot about that. Matter of fact, nobody ever told me. That's why I got that secondary illness called big shotitis. But through the years, this program is not about just not using. If you're new here and you're not using for a while, that's great. I'm glad that you haven't used. But if we don't change the way we think, we're going to use again. And the steps are designed to help us change the way we think. You can see these meetings like this, campouts, picnics, and conventions, they're all great, they're all good and fine, but they're not going to keep you clean. What I was told is I needed to get a sponsor. And they kept bugging me about getting a sponsor. So I said, okay, I'll shut these people up and I'll go get me a sponsor. The first four people I asked to sponsor me all turned me down. Every one of them. I was starting to get involved with this complex. But every one of those four people told me exactly the same thing. What they said was, Bobby, you need to get a man sponsor. So I decided to get this guy who was the secretary of the very first meeting I went to. And this guy was this big, white Iowa farmer type looking guy. He had blonde hair, crew cut, he was big, he wore overalls and a t-shirt. And I said, now that guy I can get over on. That guy don't know me. He don't know where I've been or what I've done. I'll get him. You see, I didn't trust. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. I didn't trust anybody. I was born and raised a Mexican my whole life. I didn't trust white people, to tell you the truth. And so I said, I'm gonna ask this guy to be my sponsor because he don't know me. He don't know nothing about me. I can get overrun. So he tells me, I asked him, you want to be my sponsor? And he said, sure, be honored to. He gave me the book. He wrote his name and his phone number in it. And he says, just read the black stuff that's on the white pages because there's nothing else in there. Now, that went right over my head. I didn't understand what that meant. I thought he was being funny or something. I thought he was being funny. But as time went on, he was a general contractor, and he put me to work as a gopher because I had no skills. But I learned a lot about working construction and you know, doing a little bit of electricity, plumbing, and all that stuff. I learned from him because I helped him on his jobs. And so that's what we did. We worked. We didn't work any steps. We worked together. And at about 3.5 years clean, I was at that place again where spiritually I was still bankrupt. Emotionally, I was still a midget. I still get angry. There was a couple of times where I had to be stopped at meetings from hitting people. I did hit one guy. You know, I'm not proud about it. You know, I had about 18 months clean. The guy got in my face a little bit too close, and I socked him up. And because that's where I came from. That's what I used to do. At about 3.5 years clean, I was at my sponsor's house, and I told him, you know what, I don't want to be here. And he says, well, there's the door, don't let it hit you on the ass on the way out. I said, no, you don't understand, I don't want to be here. He says, you want to get high? I said, no, I'm never going to get high again, but I don't want to be here. And he understood what I meant. You see, every night, what I was doing, even though people used to tell me that I was doing good because I was involved in a lot of service, I was what they call an NA parrot. I'd go out meetings out of town. I'd go to San Francisco, San Jose, even over to Fresno, and listen to people with more time than me. And then I'd go back and what I hear them say, I used to repeat it in my meetings, and I repeated it like I said it. And people would pat me on the back and tell me I'm doing good. You know, one of the only reasons that I stayed around that long, 3.5 years, was because nobody told me to leave. Now, they kept telling me to keep coming back. And I hadn't heard that in a long, long time, and it felt good. So what my sponsor told me that night was that it's okay to seek outside help. So I'm going to refer you to this woman who was a therapist, who was in the fellowship. And when I interviewed with her to get into this group, it's called the ACA group, Adult Children of Alcoholics. And as a kid growing up, I was abused physically, spiritually, emotionally, and sexually. And there's a lot of stuff that I was holding on to. There's a lot of anger inside. That little kid that used to be so happy and loved to play and have fun was stuck inside there, and this monster took over. This monster scared the hell out of me every time I looked in the mirror, because I was like a bomb waiting to explode. So when she says, in order for you to get into this group, you need to make me a promise, she had me actually signing a document that I was going to begin working steps. And I said, okay, what have I got to lose? So I got into therapy, and I was in therapy for about 18 months, almost 2 years. And I started working steps. And the first step, I surrendered. And that's what it's about. And I thought surrendering, being powerless, meant weakness. I grew up by a stern Mexican father who used to hit me when I cried. I had an older brother who used to beat me up all the time. And the way I get him to stop hitting me was I start crying. So he'd feel sorry for me and quit hitting me. But then my father would take over because I was crying. And I used to get, if you want to cry, go outside. I don't want to hear you. I don't want to see you. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. And I got it. So I quit crying. When I was 12 years old, my father beat me for the last time with his belt buckle. Knocked me down on the bed and beat the shit out of me. When he got done, I didn't cry. When he got done, I stood up and I looked him right in the eye and said, are you done? And he never laid a finger on me again after that. And I became this hard, mean individual. And my mother was even afraid of me. So, when I decided that I was going to work these steps, and they said, you got to surrender. You know, I'm from old school. I don't surrender. I never give up. And they said, it's not about giving up. It's about changing the way you think. Because your life is unmanageable. And if you change the way you think to where, you know, surrender, all that means is back up and regroup. That's what it means. So I had to regroup. And in the second step, it says, came to believe. And it doesn't say anything about making a description of what your God is. Because that God that I was raised with was still there in my head. You know, my mother used to have this picture of Jesus, one of them holographic pictures that no matter where you were in the room, he was looking at you. They used to scare me. She put the light on it and magnify it. So when they said, you got to have a God of your understanding, and I said, I have no understanding of this God. What I understand is that God is a punishing God, and I'm afraid of this God. The truth of the matter was, I believed that there was one, but I didn't know what I was supposed to do with him. And what I was taught in the second step was that we just have to believe. That's all I got to do is believe that there's one. And in the third step, I had to turn my will and my life over to his care. As I understood him. And when I read that, I thought, well, why does he want me to give him my life and my will? And my sponsor told me, he's not wanting you to give it to him. He wants you to trust in him that he's going to take care of you. And after I did my third step, we sat on our knees and we prayed, we held hands and we said the prayer. And he says, for the rest of your life is none of your business. And I said, that's a pretty bold statement to tell a Mexican like me, because I'm always in charge. And he says, you don't understand. Step one is you can't. Step two is he can. Step three is you're going to let him. So I do that every day. I get up in the morning and I ask him for the courage, the wisdom, and the strength to be able to do his will today and not mine. I've come that far in the 27 years that I've been around. Every day I have to do that. Because I don't know about anybody else, but my mind is awake 20 minutes before I am, sitting on the edge of the bed saying, wake up, Bobby, it's time to think. And it's on. And it starts right then. And if I don't curtail that, if I don't interject some sort of spiritual belief in that, my disease will take off. Because it is loud and clear. It lives in my mind. And it speaks to me in my own voice. And I've been listening to that voice for 60 years. And part of me tells me it's right. So I had to ask God to help me every day. When I did my four step, I was afraid to put down everything. I didn't want you guys to kick me out because I figured, you know, like I said, I was a legend in my own mind. I thought nobody had ever done the things that I had done. So I wrote down some of the stuff. And when I read it to my sponsor, he looked at me and goes, "That's it?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Let me tell you a little bit about myself." And he started sharing some stuff, and I'm thinking, "Well, this guy's a sick motherfucker." But that helped me. It broke the ice, and it helped me understand a little bit more that I was not alone. I wasn't the only one. And after I did that four step, he says, "Now I want you to look through that, and I want you to find your defects of character." I said, "I don't have none of those." He goes, "What do you mean you don't have none?" I said, "I don't have any defects of character." This is how sick I was when I got here. I said, what I told him was, what I'd like to believe back then was that I was one big defect looking for a character. That's what I was. So I found these defects of character, and he says, "Now I want you to prioritize them." I go, "What do you mean prioritize them?" He says, "I want you to put down the worst one on top, and then the second worst, the third worst, and so on and so forth." I said, "What good is that going to do? They're all my defects." And he says, "You'll understand once you write them down. And after you write them down, I want you to write down what they do to you, what they do to you emotionally, spiritually, and mentally, and how does that affect the people in your life?" I said, "Well, you're getting pretty deep." He said, "This is deep. This is a change of life, Bob. This is a change that you need in order to become something that you've never been." And what I was told was, if you want to get something you've never had, you've got to be willing to do something you've never done. And, you know, I never told on myself. Even when I was a kid going to catechism, I wouldn't tell the priest my sins. I would make sins up. I would never tell on myself. So I prioritized them, and I wrote about them. And then he says, "Now, see, this thing called recovery is a process. And the process is you do this. You think about it. You talk about it, you write about it, and then you think about it, you talk about it, you write about it. And what you're doing here," he told me, "was that you're introducing yourself to who you are. Because for many years you ran from yourself. This ego that I'm afflicted with," Pepe used to talk about that, "the ego is a belief system that it believes it is something that it is not. And that's what I suffered from. I wanted always to be somebody else. I wanted to be Beaver. I wanted to have the mother like him wake up every morning out with makeup on and hair done and an apron and breakfast ready and come in and shake me to wake me up instead of kick my bed or yell at me to wake up. So if I wanted to become something that I wasn't, I would have to be willing to do something that I had never done." And in the sixth step says we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And what that means is that by doing the process, by doing the writing, and understanding how these defects affected me and affected my relationships, I come to believe that I understand that this is what I am entirely ready to have God remove. But God, with all His love for me and all His infinite wisdom, has not saw fit to remove every one of them. What He's given me is opportunities for me to practice the opposite. And that's what we get to do around these rooms. We get to practice the opposite of what we used to be. So in the seventh step, it says, we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. And I said, "Well, what's up with a shortcoming? What is that?" And what I've come to find out is that a shortcoming is any person, place, or thing that will make any one of my defects of character manifest. So when I humbly ask Him, and now what I know about being humble is that we become teachable. I asked my second sponsor, Scotty, I asked him, "Do you think that I'll ever have enough humility?" He says, "Bobby, you got so much humility right now, you'll never use it all. You just got to understand what that means." I said, "Well, can you explain to me what that means?" He says, "People like me and you, sometimes the only way to humility is through humiliation." And believe me, when I was a kid, before I even understood the meaning of the word humiliation, I was very familiar with the feeling. And what he says that, when in step seven, we become teachable. And what that means is that God is not going to remove these shortcomings. What he's going to do is he's going to present teachers in my life. Because I really believe that when the student is ready, God will present the teacher. And everybody that came into my life after I decided to do that seventh step started teaching me about something, because they either pissed me off, I needed some patience, I needed some understanding, I needed tolerance, and God kept putting these people in my life so that I can learn tolerance, I can learn patience, and I can learn understanding and forgiveness. And so, as I worked through the steps, I started learning more and more about Bobby and less about you guys. Because I thought if I watched you, I could learn from you. But what I was learning was what not to do. I wasn't learning how to be loving. I wasn't learning how to be forgiving. See, forgiveness is one of the spiritual principles that not too many people talk about in meetings. And one of the things I had to learn how to do was to forgive myself before I could forgive anybody else. And the way I forgave myself was to start being a little bit better to myself. I started learning how to forgive Bobby so that I can love Bobby. And I'm a man in a room full of men, and I'm not afraid to sit here and tell you that I love Bobby today. See, when I was born, God gave me this cup. He said, Bobby, this is your love cup. I want you to go fill it up. So what I did was I extended this love cup out like this and to all friends and family. And every once in a while, I looked at that cup and it was empty. And I got upset and I threw it away. And I said, I'll go find love my own way. And I did. I thought it was love. A lot of us call it lust. So once I was able to start working these steps, and I put myself number one on step 8 when I made that list, I had to forgive Bobby. And that little kid that I had stuffed down slowly but surely started coming out. And I enjoy having fun today. I enjoy meeting people today. I enjoy doing good things for people. You know, I really like giving. And I wasn't like that before because I was a taker. Today I can tell you that I love Bobby. And what I realized was that when God gave me this cup, he said, Bobby, this is your love cup. Go fill it up. What he meant was I needed to fill it up with my love. And I have my cup, and it's full of my love. Matter of fact, it overflows, and it gets on you people, and you people give it back to me, and I've never once had to ask for it. Never once have I had to ask you if you love me. Because when I walk into these rooms like this, I feel the love. I felt the love when I walked in here. When you guys came up to me and hugged me, you introduced yourself to me, a total stranger. Not really totally strange. But we're all brothers in recovery. I got friends all around the world that I haven't met yet. Everywhere I go, and I've been to different states, and I've talked to a lot of people, and you know what? We connect immediately. Why? Because we have that common bond. We want to become better people. Now, I don't care how many years you have around here. It doesn't matter. What matters is what you want. You know, in the readings it says, we don't care who your connections were, or what you have done, or what you've used, where you've been. All we're concerned about is what you want to do about your disease and how we can help. And I see that. And I try to be that to new people. I sponsor a lot of men. We all work the steps. We all get together and we do things together. And this life is wonderful today. I'm married for my third time. My wife is actually speaking at the woman's potluck right now. We've both been married. This is our third marriage. And I'm saying it's my last, so is she. And we had a saying in our house that the first two were for practice. This time I think we got it right. Because I love this woman. And I tell her that every day, and she tells me every day, and we don't go to bed angry. She works her program, and I let her work her program, and I work mine, and she lets me work mine. And we get along great. We live in Prunedale, in this little town outside of Salinas. We got two dogs. We got a parrot. We got a pond full of fish. We have a roommate. My life is good. You know, I may not have everything that I want, but I want everything that I have. You know, I used to think that I needed all these material things so I can enjoy life. But what I come to believe is that God gave me life so that I can enjoy all of these material things. And today I look at things different. I look at life with a whole different set of glasses today. Life is good today. I may not have the money in my pocket all the time so that I can be the big shot, which is good, because I don't need to do that anymore. No, I believe that I'm a humble child of God who loves to be alive today. Life is really good today. I work with kids right now. And I swore that I was never going to work with kids again. And God says, you know what? I got something for you. And he gave me a job working with kids again. About 3 years ago, I got fired from a job. I was running a program. I was a program director of a 36-bed facility. And we were really like family. Everybody that worked there, they went through the program. I never went through the program, but they did. And I guess I let my guard down. And I got too close. And I learned a valuable lesson. Because you cannot mix work with friendship. And I understand that now. Because I got blindsided. And I got accused of some things that weren't true. And I actually got fired. And I held resentments for a long time. And I had to write about those resentments. I had to sit down with my sponsor and tell him about these resentments and how angry I was. And I had to have somebody put my gun away because I didn't want to take that gun and turn into that old idiot that I used to be. And I had to sit down with my sponsor and sit down and read that fourth step about how pissed off I was at these people. And I learned to forgive them. And I went to them and I told them, I forgive you. And I am sorry if I said anything that offended you or hurt you in any way. I still don't trust them, but I do love them. And I have forgiven them. I didn't do it for them. I did it because I wanted to be free of that burden of hate. I cannot afford to carry that type of emotion around with me today. And I did it faster than I would have 15 years ago. Because I know that that type of emotional baggage can hurt me. Not only will it hurt me, it would have ruined my life. It would have ruined my marriage, my job, and everything else. So if you're new here, what I'm asking you is to please stay here. They say the newcomer is the most important person at any meeting. That's true, unless I'm in the room. Because I have to be the most important person in my life today. Because if I'm no good to me, then I can't be any good to you. And I'm glad that you are here, the newcomers. Get a sponsor. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If you go to a meeting every day and you don't get married between meetings, you might have a chance. So the idea of doing something different is scary. And if you're new here and you think you've been here for a while and you tell yourself you don't want what we got, then it's all out there waiting for you. But I have one question for you. If you don't want what we have, ask yourself, do you want what you have? Because if you don't want what you have, then we have something different that we have to offer you. It's called recovery. And it's not just about not using. It's about living life, enjoying it, being good to yourself so that you can be good to other people. That's what recovery is about. I'm going to tell you one last story, and then I'm going to shut up. You guys are probably all getting tired of it. This story I heard a long time ago, and it really depicts what Narcotics Anonymous is all about. By the way, did I say that I love this program? The story goes like this. This guy dies and he goes to heaven. And he's met at pearly gates by St. Peter. And Peter says, in order to get into heaven, you got to pass this test. The guy says, let's do it. I'm ready. So he walks him over to this room, and he opens the door. And the room is 4 or 5 times bigger than this room, and there's men, women, and children sitting at this table with a feast fit for a king. Nobody's eating the food. People are sad. Some are even crying and sobbing. The problem was they had real long necks and real short arms, and they couldn't reach the food to their mouth. And Peter asks this man, what's this room? Without hesitation, the man says, that's hell. So Peter takes him to another room, opens the door. NAFTER almost knocked him down when he opened the door. There's kids running around with drumsticks of chicken in their hand and having fun and playing and laughing, and there was probably 300-350 people in that room, exactly like the room that he said was held the first time. Everybody had real long necks and real long arms in the second room, and everybody was eating food and having a grand time. And Peter asked the man, "What is this room?" Without hesitation, the man said, "That's an NA meeting." And Peter says, "Why did you identify this room as an NA meeting when the room you identified as hell was filled with exactly the same type of people? What's the difference?" Without hesitation, the man says, "Because everybody in this room is feeding each other. So thanks for feeding me this morning."
Yeah.